This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Norman Podhoretz used to describe himself as a radical, but by the late 60s, he had become disillusioned with what he's described as the anti-American tone of the left's political and anti-war protests. When Podhoretz had his political transformation, he became a founding father of neoconservatism. His friend and fellow neocon, Irving Kristol, defined neoconservative as a liberal who has been mugged by reality. Podhoretz is now in his mid-70s. This year, he was one of 13 winners of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He continues to write for Commentary, the journal that he edited for many years. His current piece is called World War IV, How It Started, What It Means, and Why We Have to Win. He uses World War III to refer to the Cold War and World War IV to refer to the War on Terror. He believes the war in Iraq is an essential part of the War on Terror. I asked him if his support has been affected by some of the problematic aspects of the war. For example, we haven't found weapons of mass destruction. We continue to fight insurgents. Fallujah and Ramadi are now controlled by fundamentalist militias. And with the pictures of torture in Abu Ghraib, those who hate Americans can now reinforce that hatred with the image of Americans torturing Muslims. Does he still think the war was the right thing to do?
Absolutely. I have no second thoughts. I think it was the right thing to do. And I think that, on the whole, the operation has been not a failure or a disaster, as many people keep saying, I think mindlessly, but a huge success as measured by historical analogies.
What are the measures you're using?
Well, talking about, I was in the Army of Occupation in Germany. I was just an enlisted man, and I was there at the tail end. But still old enough now to remember the difficulties that faced us in Germany and Japan after the Second World War. They were not the same kind of difficulties, but there were many. Not only were there many difficulties, but there were articles saying that what we were trying to do there was impossible. It could not be done. You could not create or foster democratic societies either in Germany or Japan for this, that, and the other reason, pointing to all the things that were going wrong, and many things were going wrong. Things always go wrong, not only in war, but in the efforts to reconstruct a war-torn society. And anyone with a historical sense who measures the difficulties, the cost, the problems of the what I call the Battle of Iraq, would have to say that the price in blood was very low, again by historical standards. We lost several hundred troops, including the occupation period or the Reconstruction period. 6,600 Americans were killed on a single day in D-Day, just to supply a bit of perspective here. And I could give you similar numbers for other wars that we fought. So I would stipulate, yes, I mean, not only have there been problems, some of them will continue to be problems, but the question that one always has to ask is compared to what and measured against what standard and what the balance sheet is. So I myself not only don't have any second thoughts, I think that President Bush made the right decision. It was a decision backed by a majority in Congress, and I think he is being vindicated and that the policy will be vindicated.
In your latest piece in the publication Commentary, you wrote, "The road we have taken since 9/11 is the only safe course for us to follow."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was just trying to say.
Yeah, I'm going to quote a little more. We are only in the very early stages of what promises to be a very long war, and Iraq is only the second front to have opened in that war, the second scene, so to speak, of the first act of a five-act play. What are the other acts? What do you think is next in this scenario? And does that include the invasion of other countries?
Well, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, I'm not actually making policy in detail, but I can describe the strategy to you that I think is being followed and that I support. When I say it's a very long war, I have in mind the analogy with World War III or the Cold War, which took 42 years from the enunciation of the Truman Doctrine to the fall of the Berlin Wall, which is pretty much marks the end of it, the American victory in the Cold War. I think, and I'm not alone in thinking this, many people think this, that the war into which we were plunged on 9/11 will take a comparably long time. I don't know exactly how long, but it's a long struggle. And like the Cold War, World War III, it will involve the use of many different instrumentalities of power, not just military. It's just the same thing happened in the Cold War. Economic pressures, political pressures, diplomatic, various used as appropriate in a given situation and in dealing with a given despotism that we're trying to reform or, if necessary, get overthrown. In Iran, for example, there is a very large insurgency, calls itself a democratic insurgency, that wants to overthrow the theocracy set up by the mullahs in Tehran. I still hope, it's been repressed for the moment, suppressed and repressed, that it will be possible for that insurgency to make its own way without direct American intervention, because I think it's one of the next scenes or acts in this five-act play would have to be a change of regime in Iran. I think the same is true of Syria. Now, again, military action, if we're lucky, won't be necessary or even desirable. We've seen a change in Libya without military action. I mean, Gaddafi said he was giving up his nuclear program because he was afraid he might be next on the American hit list. That's good. That's a plus, a bonus demonstration effect from Afghanistan and Iraq. But I would say that at the end of this war, if you're asking me what would happen in the last scene of Act Five, we would see the despotisms that currently oppress and dominate the lives of most of the millions and millions of people in that region in the Middle East would be replaced by regimes that at best would be democratic and at worst would be on the road to the building of democratic institutions.
Before the invasion of Iraq, one argument that was put forward is that if we invaded Iraq, ousted Saddam Hussein, and helped to create a democracy there, that democracy would spread, and that this would have a powerful and positive force on peace in the Middle East, and that that it would benefit security in Israel, which I know is an important issue for you. So, having come this far, what do you think the impact is so far on security in the Middle East?
What you already see happening throughout that region is a lot of talk about democratic reform, none of which existed before. It's all over the place, and it's quite extraordinary. It's a clear consequence of the Bush Doctrine in action in that region. Reformers have been heartened, just as dissidents behind the Iron Curtain were heartened by Ronald Reagan when he talked of the evil empire. That's one effect, one benevolent, you might say, domino effect. I mentioned Gaddafi before. As for the Arab war against Israel, well, what's one of the things that's happened is that there's an internal rebellion against Yasser Arafat, which has been squelched for the moment, but something that would have been unthinkable a couple of years ago. I think that the Bush Doctrine is also responsible for that. There can only be a settlement, as the president has said, If there is a Palestinian state that renounces terrorism and that is pledged to the building of democratic institutions, that would then make it possible to live, coexist in peace with Israel. That does not yet exist. It never has existed before. And until it exists, there will be no hope for an end to that particular war. But I would like to remind you, and it's a long story, there have been something like 23 wars in the region since the founding of Israel, in which Israel had no part whatsoever, and several million people have been killed in those wars. So the idea that peace in the Middle East is the same thing as a resolution of the conflict between the Arab world and Israel, the war of the Arab world against Israel, is ridiculous. Which doesn't mean that it's not important that that peace be brought to and security to Israel. Of course it's important.
My guest is Norman Podhoretz, one of the founders of neoconservatism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Norman Podhoretz, one of the founders of neoconservatism. Now, I know that you see the war in Iraq as being a very important part on the war on terrorism, which you describe as World War IV. But, you know, critics of the war are arguing that we're not stopping terrorism. We're creating more terrorists because what we're doing there is going so poorly and is angering so many people in that part of the world that it's becoming this incredible recruiting tool for al-Qaeda and other Islamist groups. What's your response to that?
My response to that is that it's a preposterous argument. Al-Qaeda attacked us before we were in Iraq and after a period when we were being, in effect, very nice to the regimes in that region. We are not creating al-Qaeda terrorists. We're killing a lot of al-Qaeda terrorists, and we're crippling their operation, again, not just militarily, but with use of economic power and political power. So I just think it's a silly argument, and it doesn't hold any water.
In terms of homeland security and actually protecting us against terrorists here in the United States, we're spending a fraction on homeland security that we're spending on actually fighting the war in Iraq. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's an article in Mother Jones by Matthew Brzezinski, who has a new book on homeland security, and this article is on homeland security. And he argues that, you know, we're spending so little on homeland security compared to what we're spending on the war in Iraq, and that it's leaving us vulnerable and unable to fund what we need in protecting our transportation systems, protecting our chemical plants, our nuclear plants, our coasts, and so on. He also has a chart in this, and on one column is the spending that we need for protection, and another column is marked Iraq spending equivalent. In other words, how many days of spending in Iraq would it take to fund what we need? So in the spending needed, the amount of money for basic security upgrades for subway and commuter trains in large cities is estimated at $6 billion. We don't have that money. We're only getting $100 million from the Bush administration. But that $6 billion is only 20 days of spending in the war in Iraq. Does that seem lopsided to you? Do you think that the spending on the war in Iraq is taking away from the money that we need to defend ourselves at home?
I think the whole argument is silly. Look, I would have bet everything I own 3 years ago that we would have been attacked by now and in a major way. And I thank God that we haven't been, and of course we could be tomorrow. But somebody is doing something right. I have no idea, nor do I think he does, of how much money we really need to spend. We need to spend as much as we need to spend in order to remain secure. And so far, we have got through a period when almost everybody in the world would have expected we would be attacked. We have not been attacked. So I repeat, someone is doing something right.
No, I've wondered about this. You support the Bush administration, and an important part of his base comes from the Christian right. And mm-hmm. many of the people on the Christian right believe that Christianity is the only true religion, and that at the end of days, which many people on the Christian right believe is imminent, that millions of people will be, that millions of born-again Christians will be instantly raised into heaven.
Mm-hmm.
But that everyone who is not a Christian believer will be left on earth to face 7 years of tribulation, wars, plagues, and other catastrophes until the final battles mm-hmm. between Jesus, who will have come again, and the Antichrist. Mm-hmm. And that any Jews who have not converted to Christianity will never be saved.
Yeah. Well, that, first of all, that's one segment of the so-called religious right, and by no means the central one. But I don't even want to get into their theology. As my friend and fellow founding neocon father Irving Kristol once said, when the second coming materializes or happens, we'll find out whether this is true or not. And in the meantime, to the extent that these people are our friends and allies, we should accept them as such. And that's how I feel about most of the people I know who are identified with, who are conservative Christians.
It doesn't bother you that for some of them, your religion is a false religion?
Well, sure, it bothers me. But I have to say that if you press me, I mean, you know, I don't think Christianity is the true religion. Does it bother them? I suppose it does. But we've learned how to live with these differences in our society. It's taken hundreds of years, but we have finally reached a point where we understand how to coexist and tolerate one another's religious and theological beliefs.
On this week of the Republican Convention, I'm wondering that when you watch conventions now on television,
you don't. No, I didn't watch the Democratic convention, but I'll probably watch some of this. I don't know. I mean, I watched Kerry's speech, but that's all.
Well, you're so involved in American political thought. Why are you not paying much attention to the conventions?
Well, for the same reason that the networks aren't paying much attention to them. They're not what they used to be, and they're just big shows. Nothing of great significance happens at them, which was not true in the past. I mean, in the past there was a lot of suspense. There were platform fights that really meant something. There was a question of who would be chosen vice presidential candidate, you know, that kind of thing, which delegations would be seated. Nothing like that happens. The whole thing is now predetermined, and the only question is whether the candidate makes a really effective speech. I think that's about all that's left.
The literature about the neoconservative movement makes it seem that when you had your conversion from liberal or radical to conservative, that it meant parting ways with a lot of your liberal or radical friends.
Sure.
And I'm wondering, many years beyond that transformation, do you have friends who are liberal?
No. I mean, I do. I have acquaintances who are liberal and with whom I have civil relations if I happen to run into them at dinner parties. But I have almost no friends any longer who are liberal, and I suspect that this is true of most people on both sides of the divide. I've never seen, well, I mean, since the 60s, the polarization has become more and more intense, and there are fewer and fewer friendships that can be sustained across the divide between left and right in this country. It's a great shame, but it's a reality. I wrote a book called Ex-Friends all about this, about my own experience, and tried to explain why it was so difficult for people who take political ideas really seriously to maintain friendships with people who have other points of view. I mean, what religious differences used to be and aren't anymore, in our world, not in the Muslim world, political differences have become. They've acquired a religious intensity and are tinged with a kind of intolerance that used to characterize religious differences, and that characterize religious differences far less now than they characterize political differences.
But in some places, it's a combination of the two, that the political differences are also religiously based.
Yeah, well, it depends, again, I mean, which places you're looking at. To me, the stridency of the liberal community, so-called liberal community, it's not liberal at all in any traditional sense. The stridency and intolerance and bigotry that I find marking the liberal community reminds me of the bad old days of religious intolerance of a century or two ago. I don't find anything like that degree of bigotry, really, among religious people. I do find it among some conservatives, yeah, but not among most religious people I happen to know.
Do you think that James Carville and Mary Matlin should be giving us all lessons in how to get along?
Well, I've often said nobody knows what goes on inside someone else's marriage, and that marriage is a great mystery to me. And how they get along, I really don't know. I mean, it would be very nice if we could all get along, but in the real world, it doesn't seem to work that way.
Norman Podhoretz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Norman Podhoretz has an article in the current edition of Commentary called World War IV, How It Started, What It Means, and Why We Have to Win.